There is so much happening in the world, including in our nation, our country. A lot of good. A lot of stuff is causing stress, too, especially in the world of politics. So I want to bring back to you a conversation that I had some time ago with Dr. Martha Ginn, who is shedding some light on this and helping us gain a better understanding, a better grasp of what's happening and why. So here we go with that conversation.
Listening to WTHB 1550 AM Augusta, a Perry Broadcasting Station.
Well, hello and welcome to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr., where you are in time for a great eye-opening discussion. It has to do with politics, has to do with justice, has to do with nominations. We're going to be hearing from Dr. Martha Ginn. I'll be speaking with her about the latest Supreme Court Justice nomination. But before we go there, I want to share with you a little bit of information about who Dr. Martha Ginn is. She's currently serving as Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at Augusta University. She earned her PhD in American Politics from the University of South Carolina, and her research interests include judicial decision making, public opinion of the judiciary, media coverage of elections, and the role of terrorism and voter turnout. Dr. Ginn, I tell you what, you are really covering some interesting bases here.
Thank you.
It is truly a pleasure to have you with us. And, you know, I shared that information with our listening community, but I know that there's much more to Martha Ginn than I have just shared. So, Dr. Ginn, if you would, share with us just a little bit, just before we get into the discussion that I've just talked about. Let us know a little bit more about Dr. Martha Ginn. What really grabbed your interest with regards to political science? How did you decide that you would focus on what's happening within the judiciary?
Oh, sure. Well, as an undergraduate, I majored in political science, and then I thought I wanted to go to law school, and then I realized that I didn't want to go to law school, and so instead I wanted to study the courts and basically to try and understand why justices make the decisions that they make, or lower court judges make the decisions that they make. So I ended up at South Carolina, and very great school for what I wanted to study, and then ended up here at Augusta University back when it was Augusta State, and have enjoyed teaching in our department and helping other students figure out what they want to do and to explore the political realm. And what's interesting in political science is that we do take a scientific approach to human behavior and really try and understand why people make the decisions that they make, and I find that fascinating.
And you know what? That is fascinating to me, too. The fact that we make the decisions we make, but now you've added another component to that that really grabs my attention, why people make the decisions that we mm-hmm. make. That is something that, if we have time, and if this is something that you don't mind adding to the mix, we could look into a little bit later in the discussion.
It sounds great.
Great. Okay. So we have this issue where we have a Supreme Court justice or at least a nominee, mm-hmm. Mr. Gorsuch, who has been nominated by our president, Donald Trump. And it looks like on the one hand, he may be a shoo-in. On the other hand, maybe not. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, your insights about that?
This is such a complicated nomination. You know, we talked about we're going to do a little bit of history. I mean, obviously, I think most people understand that this is the seat left vacant by Justice Scalia when he had passed away unexpectedly back last winter, and the Democrats thought that they were going to be able to replace Justice Scalia with a more liberal or moderate justice, and then obviously we know the Republicans basically refused to even hold hearings on the nominee when then President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, which is actually in and of itself an interesting nomination because Merrick Garland really didn't fit the bill of the other nominees put forth by President Obama, and he was actually quite moderate. So I think that President Obama went to extreme lengths to nominate someone that would be palatable to the Republicans, but they drew this line in the sand and basically said, we're not going to hold hearings at all. The Democrats obviously balked at that, but they didn't fight it as much as I think in retrospect they wished they would have, because they assumed that they were going to win the presidency and it would all be moot, and obviously that's not what happened. Yes. And so then President Trump got to nominate someone, and so he chose to nominate Gorsuch, and now we're sort of going back to the way in which things are supposed to happen procedurally, where the nominees announce, they meet with the relevant senators, and they have the judiciary hearings, and then they have the full vote in the House or in the Senate on that. And obviously the stage we're at now is we've just wrapped up the judiciary hearings and the Republicans are ready to move to the floor confirmation vote, but you have the issue of the filibuster, and you have the Democrats suggesting that they're willing to filibuster this nomination, and because the Republicans don't have 60 votes, they could do that, right? But the problem is the Republicans do have 52 votes, so they have enough to confirm, and that's something people don't always understand with these types of nominations. They just need a majority to be confirmed. So they have the 52 votes, or I guess technically they only need 51 votes, to confirm Gorsuch to the court, but they don't have the 60 votes to end debate, or the cloture vote to end a filibuster that several of the Democratic senators have suggested that they're willing to do. So the question becomes, what's going to happen? They've already delayed the vote or the attempt to a vote until next week, and the Democratic senators have, a lot of them have come out and said they're willing to filibuster. No one has come out directly and said that they're willing to vote to end the filibuster. So right now that leaves the Republicans with two options. They can obviously withdraw the nomination if they can't end the filibuster, or they can vote to get rid of the filibuster. And that's what we call the nuclear option, because yes, it has serious ramifications. Now, the Democrats did that. They exercised the nuclear option for all other presidential appointments about 3 years ago. So they voted, part of it, you've had a stalemate with judicial appointments for years across, both party administrations. And so the Democrats basically got frustrated. The Republicans were thwarting the nominations of lower court judges. So they ended the filibuster for all appointments below the Supreme Court, but you still have it for the Supreme Court. Obviously, this came back on the Democrats as President Trump was picking his cabinet, right? They didn't have the ability to halt nominations, and ones who were confirmed by narrow margins might not have been confirmed had they not done that. So I think that they need to have a serious gut check as to whether or not they want to remove the filibuster from the nomination of Supreme Court justices. And it'll be interesting to see in the next week or so if some more moderate Democrats or some Democrats who come from states that, help put President Trump in the White House, if they are going to say, you know what, it probably does behoove me to just vote in favor of the cloture vote. I won't vote for Gorsuch to be confirmed to the court, but I'm going to go ahead and vote to let the vote itself happen. And I think that has political costs both ways, right? If they vote to end the debate or to the cloture vote in favor of that, then obviously that's going to anger the more liberal voters or the Democratic voters who are still rightfully mad about what happened with the Garland situation. But what they can say is essentially, well, we're mad about the Garland situation too, but at some point we have to do the right thing, right? We have to let this process work the way that it should, and the way to do that is to make sure he has an up or down vote in the Senate. We were denied that, but two wrongs don't make a right, so we're going to go ahead and let that happen. And I think that some reasonable voters will accept that. I mean, I think on some level, everyone looks at this and realizes we haven't had a full Supreme Court for a year.
Yes.
And that's had some meaningful ramifications for our state of the law. I mean, mm-hmm. you've had cases that have ended up 4-4 splits, which means the lower court ruling stands as law, but only law for that circuit. So the court has basically wasted resources, which are limited, gone through the and the individual litigants too, you know, have spent these resources. And of course, they get their outcome, but the Supreme Court chooses cases that they think have national significance, right, and or that need resolving because circuits are deciding them differently, and you can't have, you know, one verdict in one part of the country and a different one in another and call that justice. So you have these cases coming before the court. You have a 4-4 split, and now we don't know what the answer is.
And so the whole nation is in limbo with a lot of these issues. And as you mentioned, so much has been held up, even on the lower courts. Haven't we also had quite a few nominations held up because our politicians decided that they did not want those people mm-hmm. sitting on those courts for their various political reasons? And hasn't the problems with bottlenecks in the judicial system occurred not only at the Supreme Court level, but the lower levels as well? And if so, how does that impact the nation?
Yeah, and that's something that's been going on at least since the Clinton administration, if not before, but it was exacerbated strongly in the Clinton administration with the Republicans refusing to confirm nominees put up from his White House. And obviously it has this cascading effect because, you know, they're overworked and understaffed to begin with, and then you have vacancies that they don't fill, and then the workload continues to increase and they still are understaffed. And so that's part of the rationale for the Republicans exercising that nuclear option for the lower court nominees, right? That they have to fix this bottleneck or this over capacity. And a lot of it just comes down to this whole idea of, you know, hyper-partisanship and the refusal to really work together on certain things that require a bipartisan solution. I mean, if you look, you know, historically at nominations, you have a couple in, say, the Reagan administration with Bork and some other nominees, or even going back to Nixon. But for the large majority of confirmations, the votes are fairly large, the margin such that, I mean, even if you go back to, say, the Bork era, when after you have Rehnquist confirmed as the Chief Justice under Reagan, he then nominated, that was a pretty contentious fight, but then he nominates Justice Scalia, who we're talking about his vacancy. He was confirmed unanimously. And you see that idea of, you know, the judiciary is supposed to be, you know, above partisanship, et cetera, and we've lost our way in that. And now we're in a situation where we've gone a year without a justice, and, you know, one party saying you can't do this, another party saying, oh, yes, we can, and if we have to, we'll do it through, you know, a process that isn't the one that we've used for the past 200 years.
And that said, I'm looking at this situation. You know, we hear a lot of people say, and I mean constituents, we hear politicians say it, I'm not looking for someone who is a political ideologue to be placed on the court. I don't mm-hmm. want a political ideologue. Do you find that is true of most of our politicians who make that claim? Or does that seem to, does the opposite seem to be reality?
They clearly want someone that mirrors their political ideology. You know, and we of course want to say that, you know, justices or any judge don't you know, vote in an ideological manner. But, you know, as I tell my students, if you could have one piece of information, if you're trying to predict how a certain judge or justice votes, what would it be? And ultimately, they come around to, I would want to know who appointed them, right? Mm-hmm. Because in general, the person that appoints them is going to try and choose someone who's going to reflect their ideology, because that person is going to serve long after they've completed their term in the White House. And that's true with the senators that are involved in the advising and consenting process of any judicial nominations as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking with Dr. Martha Ginn. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at Augusta University. She teaches undergraduate courses on judicial process, constitutional law, and mock trial, among others. I want you to stay with us as she shares some tremendous insights with us regarding our judicial system and the nomination process.